Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, before I call our second case, my notes up here tell me that we have two high schools. Brookfield Central High School, if you are here, would you please stand, students and faculty? Very nice. Please be seated. Also, I'm told that Union Grove High School may be here with faculty. If you are, will you please stand? Oh, very nice. Thank you. Please be seated. We like to have the students come and visit us. It's a part of our programming that I like very much. When we finish this argument, if you all can stick around, Justice Rebecca Bradley, right down there, two down, will come down and speak with you a little bit, not about the case that we're about to hear, but about how matters get to the Supreme Court and a variety of other things that she can tell you and questions that she may be able to answer for you. Anybody else who wants to attend Justice Bradley's conversation after this case is over is, of course, welcome to do so. All right, I'll now call our second case, Nick Leash versus Boardman Clark. Are you prepared to proceed, counsel? Please do so.
May it please the court, I'm Doug Kammer from Portage, and I represent the McLeish siblings. There are four of them. I'm not going to beat up all the things I said in my brief. There's no reason for that. But I'll try to cut to the chase as well as I can. This case turns on an old will drawn sometime in the 60s and probated in the 80s. And that will is set forth in all your materials. But there's a paragraph, I believe it's number 3, which says essentially that the widow, this is the death of a husband first, the widow is to be given a life estate in the entire estate with the remainder to these four siblings.
Is that your characterization, or is that a quote from the will?
I can quote the will if you'd like, but it's a characterization, but it's close.
Let's go with the language of the will.
Say it again, please.
Let's go with the language of the will. I can supply it for you if it might be easier. It says, all the rest of my property, in relevant part, I give to my beloved wife, Thelma McLeish, to use the income and so much of the principal as she may need for her care, comfort, and support during her lifetime, meaning and intending hereby to give to my wife, Thelma McLeish, the life use of the income and so much of the principal as she may need. Yes?
That's correct. Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry. I'm not prepared to pull that out of the stack of things immediately.
No worries.
That has been characterized by two trial courts and two appellate courts, and I think by the respondent in this case as a life estate, which is what it is as far as I'm concerned. That conclusion is driven not by some esoteric principle, but by Wisconsin property law. Now, a typical life estate, or often a life estate, does not include a power to invade or a power to consume corpus. So normal life estates do not allow, if it's a life estate in the woods, for example, do not allow the life tenant to go in and cut all the walnut trees and diminish the life estate for the remainderment. Nonetheless, a life estate is a life estate.
Yeah. This one did, though, correct?
This one did, yeah. Okay. This was a little bit unusual. But that drives the quality of the life estate. That doesn't change the reality that it's a life estate with a remainderman, four remaindermen, and that's been acknowledged by all the courts all the way up, and I think that's correct beyond any question. Now, the problem is, the underlying problem, and I am simplifying this because I think we've made it more complicated than it should be, the problem is that when Charlie McLeish died, and his will was probated in the 80s. What happened is that, for one reason or another, instead of a life estate mechanism of one type or another being set up, the fee interest was transferred to the widow. And untoward things followed from that were damages to the plaintiffs.
And was that because it was a fee interest or because of the tax consequences?
Both. Both. And I'll set them forth. I'll be very brief about it.
Let me just direct you to your reply brief at pages 4 and 5. You say the respondent does not address the fact that the siblings got nothing from their father's estate. It is from this error and not creating a life estate with a remainder interest that all of the damages flow.
That's correct.
Yeah? Okay.
That's exactly the position we take.
Are you suggesting that that there should have been some part of the estate that got titled in the siblings' names?
It should have been named, like all life estates. We don't have real estate involved in this, but the security should have been entitled Thelma McLeish for life, Robin McLeish et al. Remainderman, or something like that.
And would that have made any difference at all to the tax treatment?
I'll be happy to address that, Judge. It would have. It would have done that. Let me just run through the sequelae that followed from this. One is that when Thelma died 25 years later, that's the widow, her estate needed to be probated because fee had vested in her and all this stuff. And that probate cost about 100 grand, I think 96,000 or something, but roughly 100 grand. Secondly, because Thelma's estate had to be probated, these assets were tied up for 15 or 16 months in a lengthy probate during a time when the stock market was crashing, and these siblings didn't have a chance to try to protect themselves. Now, I don't know exactly how you protect yourself. I guess that's something for more prudent investors than I am to know. But there are ways to, at least you should have a right to try to protect yourself when your assets are diminishing.
Were the four children adults at the time their dad died?
I think so.
They were.
So.
And were they emancipated adults in that they were out and on their own?
I believe so.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. There was a provision in the will for juveniles, but that is not operative, and no one's talking about it. Justice, you asked me about the estate tax, and I want to speak to that because that does also follow from the failure to set up a life estate properly, as we think it should have been set up.
Yeah, and I don't think there's any need to get into the weeds of the taxes. That's just kind of the...
Yeah, no, I understand that, and I'll try to stay out of the weeds, but I do want to just make a comment about it.
Right. So as you address it, if you could address it in this context, did the titling of the assets preclude a different tax treatment?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Had the life estate been set up, what would have happened at the federal level, I believe, is what happened at the state level. And that is set forth in the record. I think it's record 75, page 5, but there's the state tax return. And what happened was the probating lawyer had to make a proration for his state for inheritance tax purposes, not for state tax purposes, but inheritance tax purposes. And that division would have obviated all this problem, because I think he would have had to file then the federal return, had he done this, showing what was sheltered in the widow's exemption as her interest in the estate, which was roughly $300,000, something like that. And then $340,000 would have fallen into the estate and remained there to be taxed. The exemption was $325,000, so the tax on the first estate would have been something like $6,000 or $7,000. And that's set forth in a letter that's at R57. I can't remember what page it is there, but there's a letter set forth from the defendant that explains how that was done at the state tax level. So the losses were an estate tax problem, which would have been obviated, a second probate, which was expensive, and a second probate, which caused the siblings to be unable to protect themselves in a falling market because their securities were tied
up. Did Thelma invade the principal? Did she use any of the securities that were left to her?
Did she in fact do that?
Yeah.
No, she didn't. She was a good, frugal farm wife, and she viewed this property as her kids, and she kept it hoarded forever.
Okay, so we're talking about securities, so she must have had a farm that she had at some point in time then, right? She was living on something.
She had nominal real estate, and I believe she lived with her son, David.
Okay. Thank you.
What about the argument that was made that no one complained about this for 23 years, and if this was such a significant issue and they named and it was named incorrectly, that someone could have spent that time contesting it at that point?
Judge, I don't know what the legal framework is for that assertion. I saw it in the Court of Appeals. We certainly felt that was a big factor. I don't know. It wasn't justified in terms of any legal principles. I think it's analogous to a surgical instrument left in a patient. The patient just doesn't know about it. And these kids certainly had no reason to challenge their mother. She was a delightful person and took good care of everything. And so they had no reason to challenge that over the years.
Well, what about?
But they were amazed to learn that they had no vested interest in the estate.
What about Thelma challenging it, though, if she would understand what it should have been called? You're saying she didn't know either?
The answer is I don't know. I don't know Thelma. I don't know what she thought. I have no idea. I don't represent her. I don't know anything about it. I think there's a point here in which we have to interject some reality, too, in this. People trust their lawyers, and you can see from Charlie's will that the request was from Charlie that this go back to the, at that time, the Hartman firm to be probated, and I have every reason to believe they had a long-term course of dealings. I certainly would assume that's the case. That's the way it is with country lawyers as far as I know, and I've been one for half a century. So I would be very surprised that she'd come back 10 years later and challenge her lawyer on the way these securities are titled. I just wouldn't think that would happen. So, Judge, we're in a position now where we have what I think is negligence for a number of reasons. We have a negligent act by a lawyer, and we come here entangled in a standing problem, which also is sort of an immunity problem. The court's kind of waving back and forth with standing and immunity. I'm urging you to adopt the restatement position, and I'm not going to recite exactly what the full title of it, but it's in the briefing. The restatement position is the more modern view of this, and it gets away from the underlying problem of lawyers' immunity and parties' lack of standing. A brief word about that. This I can see from the history of these cases as I read them, that this court historically has been concerned about some disgruntled person suing his adversary's lawyer. And I understand that. You can't have that happen. You're going to end the practice of law as we know it if that were to happen. But I don't see that as being a particularly insurmountable problem. The people who put together the restatement have found a neat way of handling that, in my opinion. I didn't think I should tailor something on my own. I'm not smart enough to do that. But this is a very clever way to handle this.
Well, counsel, before we go into
sure.
that, I want to make sure that we're going to be following the right path of analysis here.
Yes.
At page 5 of your brief, your main brief, you say plaintiffs lost this case below and in the Court of Appeals on the basis that attorneys are immune from suit by someone other than their clients.
Yes.
Right? I'm wondering if that's entirely accurate. And I'd like to turn your attention to the Circuit Court's decision and order at page 8, where it says, in sum, Alrick, Beauchamp, and Tensfeld established that a third-party beneficiary of a will may maintain a legal malpractice action for negligence against an attorney only where the beneficiary can show the attorney's actions thwarted the decedent's testamentary intent. Applying that to the case at hand, plaintiff's case survives summary judgment only if they put forward some evidence showing that Charles' testamentary intent was thwarted.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so the circuit court found that you did not prevail, not because attorneys are immune from suit, but because you didn't show any evidence that Charles' testamentary intent was thwarted.
That,
right?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Is that correct? That's the basis for the circuit court's decision.
Judge, this question of standing and the question of thwarting the intent are all interwrapped, and that happened as a result of the Orrick case.
Well, So the circuit court said, if you can show that Charles' testamentary intent was thwarted, you'd have standing. Right?
That's what that opinion seems to say.
Okay.
May I speak to that?
Sure.
There is an equivocation that's going on, both in the trial courts and the higher courts. My position is that the siblings were entitled to a remainderman's interest in Charlie's estate, and I don't think there's any dispute about that. But what the courts are doing is looking at this thing saying, well, they got the property out of the estate. Well, the estate is not Charlie's estate. They got the money because their mother had the same objects of bounty as the father did, and she preserved these assets, and so they got their money from their mother. But they didn't get it out of Charles' estate. But the equivocation is made all the time in all these courts saying, yeah, but they got their dough, no harm, no foul.
Okay, so let's set aside the equivocation. The circuit court said you could proceed if you could show that Charles' testamentary intent was thwarted.
Yes.
Right? And they said you didn't show that, right?
We didn't show it based on the equivocation, yes.
All right, so that's why I'm wondering why we're here is to talk about attorney immunity or whether there was any showing of a thwarting of testamentary intent.
The immunity was, how am I going to say this? There was a notch put in the immunity in the Orrick case that talked about frustrating the intent
right.
of the deceit.
And is it your position today that Charles' testamentary intent was thwarted?
Yes.
Okay. Then the circuit court said that attorneys were not immune to your suit.
That doesn't get me into court, Judge. They held that it was, that we hadn't proven that.
Right.
And so we lost it.
Right. But that's a different matter than immunity, isn't it? That's a question of your proof.
Judge, we're all wrapped up in this field between standing, immunity, and duty. And this has become an alphabet soup because of the court's antipathy for being in a position where they say you can sue your adversary.
But the court held the door open for you, didn't it? It said, here's the door you can walk through. It's called thwarting the testamentary intent.
Yes.
You have proof to do that.
Yep.
And the circuit court said, we're not closing the door on you. We just don't see your proof.
They said yes, and what you brought forth is not sufficient proof or not proof,
right.
And so I lost it.
Counsel, did you provide to the circuit court copies or some other record of the securities being titled solely in Thelma's name?
I believe so, but I'm sorry to ask.
Did you provide a copy of the will?
Oh, certainly.
Okay.
Certainly. Yeah.
And where would you look for a decedent's testamentary intent?
In the will.
Okay. And what is it you say the will is supposed to have provided these securities with the names of the children as remaindermen on them, correct?
Yes, that's a matter of property.
Okay, so was that provided to the circuit court so the circuit court could see, compare the will with the securities?
I think so. I'm not positive about that. I think it was done as part of the deposition of our late-named expert. I think the portfolio was there. I'm not positive about that, Judge.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. At any rate, the fact is that they were not entitled as a life interest, but entitled in fee, and that drove the second probate. Had they been, let me do it backward, had they been entitled Thelma McLeish, life tenant, Robin McLeish et al., remainderman, then certainly the second probate would have been obviated. And in fact, obviously obviated. I mean, anyone would have just terminated the life estate. And under Wisconsin property law, which drives this question, the decedent's interest at the moment of her death is zero, and so she has no estate except the incidental things she may be garnered on her own. But as to the bulk of the family wealth that came through Charlie, there was zero interest in the widow at the moment of her death. And had that happened, this mess would have been avoided. don't know if I answered your question very well or not. I hope I did.
Well, I was looking at the proof. You know, Justice Kelly started down the path with you that the door was open for you to prove it.
Yeah.
And I tend to agree with you. If you're looking for the testator's intent, you would start with the will.
Sure.
Okay. And then if you're arguing about securities and you're saying, well, they weren't titled in the correct person's name, one would think you'd have to show that they weren't by providing the securities. Right?
I don't think there was ever a dispute. Acknowledged it, but I think it's in the record anyhow. I can't swear.
Okay, well, I was trying to figure out why you failed in your proof.
What's interesting about this and what's really frustrating to me about it is that all judges looking at this case coming up have said it's a life estate. But for some reason or other, it doesn't get at home that it was never vested as a life estate. And part of that is because we suggested early on under the Martin case and that series of cases that the sensible way to administer this thing was to put it in a trust at that time. And I still stand by that. That's the way it should have been handled.
Is that required?
Well, there's not a trust in the will, though, unless the children are underage.
But if you look at the Martin case says oftentimes probate judges impose trusts on these things for administrative purposes. A trust of convenience is what they're calling it. Because the problem is that with the sands of time, the remainder man's interest gets lost, and that could have happened here. It didn't. But it could have happened.
Okay. Right, but that was not required by the will.
And the probate courts didn't want to keep the files open forever.
Yeah.
So they were using trust for that.
Right. And that might have been a prudent way of handling it, but that was not required by the will, correct?
It was not specifically required by the will. That's correct.
Okay. So the absence or presence of a trust cannot go to thwarting the testator's intents?
Unless the trust would have been the vehicle by which the will was fulfilled, that is to say that the remainderman's interests were acknowledged in the trust document or the testamentary trust implied by the court.
Okay. But
somehow or other that remainderman's interest just got lost in the shuffle in Charlie's estate.
All right. So the trust, we can set that aside because that was a question of prudence, right?
Yep.
Okay.
And it turns out it's also true for the estate tax problem. The decisions on how to process the estate tax could have been handled the same way with a trust, as it could be with a life estate that is correctly set up.
And you could have, in the way it actually was handled, as far as the titling of the assets, you still could have changed the handling of the taxes, correct?
Say that again.
Sure. So let's say the assets in Charlie's estate were titled the way they were when the estate got probated.
Yes.
The tax elections could have still been different from the way they actually were done, correct?
I think so.
Okay. So the tax election is not really a question of testamentary intent either, correct?
Except I think that had the life estate been set up either as a trust or as a life estate as a matter of property law, I think the tax consequences would have followed, and the widow's exemption would have been to the widow's interest, and the sibling's interest would have been left in the residue to be subjected to the estate tax maze as it then existed.
Okay, it may have, right? But they still could have done it. The tax elections still could have been done differently. In fact, they could have been done the way that you wanted them to do,
yeah,
even though the assets were titled the way they actually were, correct?
Yes, they could have been. It could have been done.
All right. So,
but that doesn't solve the other two problems, which is the second estate.
All right. So if I understand correctly, then your position is that the frustration of the testamentary intent,
yes,
was in the titling of the assets when Charlie's estate got probated.
Either in the titling of the assets or in the failure to use some sort of a trust vehicle, that's the same thing. So
well,
that the preservation of the remainderman's interest, okay, was the problem.
So the trust, we've already said we can set that aside because that's,
yep,
a prudential question.
Sure.
Right? So we're trying to get to what was the frustration of testamentary intent. And for you, that's the titling of the assets in the probate of Charlie's estate, correct?
That's correct. It was investing the widow with fee simple and all these assets when she was supposed to have a life estate.
All right. Now,
and everything follows from that.
Okay. Fair. So now, do you have any authority that language like this in a will requires titling in a particular way?
I don't know how to respond to that. I think if you leave your estate to Fred, the assumption is that deeds and securities and so forth will go to Fred. I mean, this is a matter of Wisconsin property law.
Okay. Well, and I'm looking for some.
Asking me, does the attorney actually have to follow the will?
No.
Okay.
My question is, given the language that was used in this will, which you've acknowledged is a little unusual because Thelma was able to use the principal.
Yes.
Right? So what I'm wondering is there any authority that you have that given language like this, it requires a particular type of titling? Right? That it is improper as a matter of law to title this as a fee simple interest. Do you have any authority that says that?
Judge, I think it's the lawyer's duty to follow the will, and if the will calls for a certain form of conveyance and that the assets pass to a certain beneficiary, I think he has a legal duty to do that. I'm sure it's in the probate code. I can't.
Completely agree.
Yeah.
So what I'm asking is, given this particular language that allows Thelma to use the principal.
Yes.
What I'm looking for is any authority, statutory, common law, anything, that says, given that kind of language, here's the titling that you need to use, right? That tells us you have to title it in this particular way.
Judge, I see this as exactly the same as if the lawyer had entitled all of the stock in the name of the Lutheran Church. I mean, the Lutheran Church was not the beneficiary.
Okay.
And the lawyer's got to follow the beneficiary scheme and the will.
I don't think you're getting my question.
Yeah.
The beneficiary clearly was Thelma.
Among others?
Okay. So the question is then, given that the bequest to Thelma said, here's my estate. You can use the whole thing. Whatever you don't use goes to the children when you die, right? What I'm looking
some for, limitation, but not great.
Yeah. Okay. So what I'm looking for is a Wisconsin authority that says, given that kind of language, here's the titling that you use, right? I'm not interested in whether he titled this to the Lutheran Church. He didn't. He titled it to Thelma, and that gave Thelma the right to use the entirety of the state during her lifetime, which is what she did.
I'm not prepared to give you an authority on exactly that point. I don't know that there is one.
Okay, well,
but I accept for the general principle that the lawyer is bound to follow the will and get the assets to the named beneficiaries.
And what I'm suggesting to you, this may have been the problem the circuit court was having. Because if you can't give us authority that says this is how you must title the property given the language of this will, how is the circuit court to know that?
Judge, I think it's an obvious conclusion. I think it's an obvious conclusion that the duty of the probating lawyer is to get the assets to the named beneficiary, whatever their interests are.
We're beyond that, though.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I don't have a case that's exactly on that point. I don't know if there is one.
My apologies, Chief.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge. Sorry, I didn't mean to go over my time.
No, that's all right. You were answering his question, and that was a good thing to do.
My name is Bruce Schultz. I represent the defendants.
Attorney Schultz, you're going to have to tip the microphone up because you're a bit taller than your opponent there. Okay, thank you.
If it helps the court at all,
that helping. Yeah.
The judgment from Charles McLeish's probate in the description of the assignment of the property, it used the words from the will as to how title was taken. Didn't say life estate. It used the exact words, the exact language of the will. That's found in plaintiff's appendix, page 87.
So what did the actual stock certificates look like then? Do we know?
Don't.
No? You don't know what they look like?
Nope.
That's not in the record.
Is That's extraordinary. I mean, we're here arguing about whether the certificates were made in compliance with the will, and the certificates are not in the record? Or at least a copy of them. Nothing?
There was an inventory. I didn't see certificates.
Okay. Well, thank you. You answered my question. I was surprised by the answer, but you did answer the question.
Counsel, on page 28 of your brief, you talk about the Stafford case and also the Kinney case. And in essence, you say that given the words of the will that allow Thelma the power to invade the principal for her care, comfort, and support, that the IRS would include the value of Charles' assets in Thelma's gross estate, regardless of whether there was a trust. I assume that you would be able to extend that assertion to regardless of how those stock certificates were entitled, or can't you extend that?
Absolutely.
And why is that under the Kelly case that, again, given, and Kinney if you want, when I say Kelly I meant Stafford, two good Irish names, given that the will gave Thelma the power to invade the principal for her care, comfort, and support, is that language under IRS deemed sufficiently ascertainable standards?
It is not.
Tell me why. I mean, what's going on here?
Health, education, maintenance, and support. Ascertainable. Care is not ascertainable. If you look at the will provides also that Thelma may use as much as she may need. That's not ascertainable. It doesn't meet the ascertainable standards. If you look at the IRS and the IRS cases that result therefrom, it's very restrictive, has to relate to health, education, maintenance, and support. Not care and not need. That's not ascertainable. The beneficiary here, Thelma, has too much discretion as to what she can do with the assets. Accordingly, whether there's a trust, whether you call it a life estate, for purposes of taxation, the IRS is going to treat this as all belonging to Thelma.
And was that the interpretation of the IRS when Charles died at that time?
It hasn't changed.
Do you have a case from when that time period in the 80s that says that?
Not off the top of my head.
Is there one in your brief that maybe I missed?
I don't recall the dates of the decisions.
Stafford was 1964, and you rely on Stafford for that premise.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate
that. So just so I'm following, then, you're saying it doesn't matter. Mr. Kammerer is relying on the fact of how this was named by the attorney, that that's the negligence, that's the failure to follow testamentary intent. And you're saying it doesn't matter what it's called, because of how it functions, it's going to result in the same amount of taxation.
Correct.
So that there was no negligence.
No negligence.
Okay.
There's no negligence. And this, I think, goes back to some of your earlier questions. Justice Kelly, and the comments from Mr. Kammerer that the courts throughout this have considered the will as creating a life estate. I'd call the court's attention to the Court of Appeals decision, which there was no issue raised as to this in the petition for review or in any of the briefing, but the Court of Appeals, paragraph 16, stated, Charles's will gave Thelma absolute power over the disposition of the assets of Charles's estate. The court continued at paragraph 18. Charles's will provided that Thelma had absolute power to dispose of the assets of Charles's estate during her lifetime, and upon her death, the residue of Charles's estate would be divided among the MacLeish children, we conclude that Charles intended to give Thelma a life estate with absolute power to dispose of the assets of Charles's estate, but subject to the future estate of the McLeish children. And that's exactly what happened here. Thelma got the assets. She had absolute power to do with them what she wanted. Charles knew his wife, Thelma. He trusted her. She didn't dispose of the assets. The children, as remaindermen, having a future interest, if Thelma did do something wrong, they could start a lawsuit for waste committed by chop down the woods, the trees in the forest, an action for waste. That never occurred. I don't think it would have been successful because Charles's will gave this absolute power to Thelma. If you look at the will, the language of the will, what transpired here is exactly what Charles intended. Wife got the full use. She had absolute power. She was thrifty. And the kids got the remainder. They got what was left. I don't know what the negligence was. I don't know how it was causal. The IRS would tax this as though it belonged to Thelma in fee because it didn't have ascertainable standards, and she was allowed not just to use the income, but also she could invade the principal, the corpus. As it relates to the issues presented, or what I believe the issues presented to this court were, the Orrick decision, from day one, we have acted as though Orrick would be expanded to apply to the probating of a will, not just the drafting or execution of a will. The lower court said it wasn't necessary to make that finding. We're now before this court. It would be appropriate to expand Orrick to the situation of the probating of a will. With respect to the adoption of the restatement third, it was never an issue in the lower court. If this court was going to adopt something that essentially absolves immunity to attorneys, I would think you'd want to do so in a case where that issue had been briefed and argued in the lower courts. It simply wasn't done here. And it's not necessary to decide the merits of this case in that an expansion of the Orrick decision covers the issue in this case. The taxes that were paid in this case that were ultimately owing weren't the result of any consequences as to how the Charles McLeish estate was probated. It was the result of how the Charles McLeish will was drafted and what it said. It was probated and carried out exactly as Charles intended. Those tax consequences and everything else flow from that. Not how it was probated. I think I'm going to quit, unless the court has further.
Okay, thank you.
Expand Orrick and affirm the decision of the lower court. Thank you.
Judge, I agree with Mr. Schultz in this regard. I think that existing law affords my people standing, and I don't think they should have been summarily dismissed, though. And there's a whole section in the brief on that.
And counsel, excuse me. Do you agree with opposing counsel that the probate judgment required the stocks to be titled according to the language used in the will?
Say it again, please.
Sure. Do you agree with opposing counsel that the order in probate required that the stocks be held according to the language used in the will?
The probate judgment, inherited the will. It's drafted, of course, by the lawyer probating the estate.
Okay. So if,
but the,
if
the probate if the, judges didn't exercise supervision at that
okay.
point.
But if the order requires that the property be held exactly according to the language used in the will, then certainly the order can't have thwarted the testator's intent, correct?
No, of course not. It wasn't followed. The order wasn't followed.
Right. So now the question is, how were the stocks actually held, right? Did it follow the order of the probate court? All right. Now, opposing counsel says we don't have the stock certificates in the record. Is that right?
We have them in the record in Thelma's estate, and it's never been an issue in this case. No one's ever raised that question because they were all inventoried in Thelma's estate as her own property. So okay. they obviously were entitled in her name, and I know that's how that was done.
Do we have any of the are there any copies of the stock certificates in the record that we could actually look at?
We are too modern for stock certificates. The stock certificates are computer entries that were generated by the First National Bank of Portage that was serving as fiduciary to keep all these assets.
Do we have a copy of those computer entries?
I think we do have, and I think it's part of the deposition of our expert who quantified the stock loss. And I didn't expect to go there. I'm sorry. I wasn't prepared to speak to that.
Well, counsel, your claim is that the stock titling is what caused the thwarting of the testator's intent.
Yes.
Why is that not then in the record?
Because it's never been challenged. No one ever challenged it. It was clear from the probate of Thelma's estate that those assets were all probated in her estate as if she owned them. And that's correct because she did own them.
But you're assigning error to the 1984 probate, not Thelma's probate, right?
Say it again, please.
You're assigning error to the probate in 1984.
Yes, that's correct.
Right? So there are two points of potential entry for an error here. Either the way that the property was handled in the probate of Charles' estate,
yes,
or the way that the property was handled in the probate of Thelma's estate.
We're not contesting the latter.
Right. So what we're trying to get at is, was there actually any thwarting of a testator's intent somewhere?
Yes.
And that requires that we have that we see the whatever document or computer entry might reflect this. It requires that we see how the stocks were held, doesn't it?
Judge, the proof is that in Thelma's estate, the entire estate was inventoried as her property.
Okay, that's not proof. That might just be an error in the probate of Thelma's estate.
Well, Mr. Schultz has never raised that as an error they made as an excuse, and so I didn't chase it down.
Okay, well, I don't know what we're supposed to do with that. I'm not sure what we're supposed to do with that because we have to look at the record as it exists. And you lost at the circuit court because the circuit court said, you presented no evidence that Charles' testamentary intent was thwarted. And I don't see anything in the record that shows that Charles' testamentary intent was thwarted. That's your responsibility to find.
Everyone accepted in the lower courts, and I accept, that the fact that these assets were inventoried 100% in Thelma's estate meant she owned them, and no one's ever said to the contrary. I mean, one doesn't chase down blind alleys in getting a lawsuit. Right,
okay, now. I would like you to address what I understand to be opposing counsel's argument that because there was no definable standard in the will, even if the stocks had been titled life estate to Thelma, remainder to the four kids, you would end up exactly where you are now.
He's got it backward in his head from the start. What we're talking about here is a Q-tip, and I don't want to go into this.
I'm not talking about a Q-tip either. Okay. What I'm asking you is
the ascertainable standard has to do with Q-tip.
Well, life estates have been around long before a Q-tip, right?
Yes, oh yes.
Okay. So you're saying that until you get to Q-tip, you don't need an ascertainable standard to show a life estate?
No, I'm not saying that.
Okay, well, then I don't understand your
I'm saying that normally, and I put this in my brief, normally this would not be taxed to Thelma. They keep asserting that it would be, but it would not be. Her power to invade notwithstanding, it's a terminable interest. And terminable interests are taxed in the estate. They're not subject to the marital exclusion. and therefore it would remain in the estate. And what they did was make a Q-tip election, which allows them to shelter part of the estate or all the estate with the marital exemption. And that's what they did. And in fact, they elected to shelter the entire estate with the marital exemption, which caused the loss in the second estate.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you, Judge.
And thank you all for an interesting argument. We don't get a lot of estate cases up here, and they're always intricate. So thank you very much. Thank you for good briefs and good argument. We are now going to adjourn, and in just a bit, Justice Rebecca Bradley will be here to talk to the students and whomever else would like to stay. We are adjourned.